Coming up next is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Tonight, we'll talk about the potential for depression with the use of social media.
Studies and also common sense has shown that a lot of people are too plugged in and they're almost in a virtual world when there are real people around them that they're not talking to.
Plus, the power of bone marrow transplants in the fight against cancer.
It allows people to reach landmarks in their life, see things they want to see, that otherwise they would miss out on.
And research on a vision issue that may herald the onset of multiple sclerosis.
The majority of people with optic neuritis is the form that it may be related to multiple sclerosis later on.
Summer safety tips and a moving piece from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we examine the power of bone marrow transplants to cure some cancers, and how visual disturbances like optic neuritis often herald the onset of multiple sclerosis. But first, we discover some surprising new research linking social media use and depression. While the increased access to technology in our lives and our currently plugged-in social environment has brought with it certain benefits, but some new research has shown that this constant barrage of social communication can also contribute to the development of some psychopathology. We'll hear with more on all of this our Dr. Teresa Blatchford. She's a fourth-year psychiatry resident in the Department of Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Mirabel Matar, a child and adolescent psychiatry fellow, also in the Department of Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So internet use, especially use of social media, has led to both what we know of as positive and negative effects. Explain that, Dr. Matar.
Well, thank you, Linda, for the introduction. It was really good. Actually, most people are plugged in right now to the social media and the internet in general and to our phones. Well, the good parts in general, which common sense says, is that we can be more connected to each other, which was not there before. I know from my parents and grandparents that they used to wait for letters for people to go in boats, and after 30 days they will get a letter, which was really painful, I can imagine. But right now we can have this more quick access. However, studies and also common sense has shown that a lot of people are too plugged in and they're almost in a virtual world when there are real people around them that they're not talking to. So this is in general what I've seen.
Mm-hmm. And certainly, Dr. Blatchford, there's been some actually well-documented association between internet use and this notion of psychopathology. I mean, some things I think that I've come across, excuse me, have been allusions to things like problems with addiction, perhaps insomnia, even psychosis and suicide. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's true. We've known about something, you know, internet addiction for some time, but now something that might be similar but also separate is social media addiction. And some of the studies we came across have shown that teenagers especially are having problems related to excessive social media use, problems that you typically see with addiction. Decreased real-life relationships and satisfaction in relationships, decreased academic performance, insomnia, depression, suicide have been shown to be connected to excessive social media use.
You know, you can't walk down the street today and not be struck by the fact that most people, especially if they're walking alone, have a phone that they're looking at.
That's true.
I mean, and usually that is, they're in contact in some way through social media, I would think, or the internet in general, emails, with another person. But it's almost like we've lost the idea or the possibility of being comfortable being alone, for one thing. Yeah. And then sometimes even when there are other people surrounding someone, they are also not looking up. They're looking down on their phone. And as you alluded to, they're not relating to the people around them. So I could see where that would absolutely potentially develop some serious kind of issues. And it's ironic to me, and I think you both must agree, being psychiatrists, that the one thing that would potentially link you to other people also has the potential to isolate you from perhaps the people right in your immediate environment.
This is very true.
So who is most at risk for this, Dr. Matar? I mean, you alluded, Dr. Blatchford alluded, yes, to teenagers, but in general, who's most at risk?
I would say more the teenagers, patients with psychopathology and mental illness at baseline may be more at risk of developing an addiction or excessive use because they are unable to form real connections in real life, or able but with difficulty, and the social media is a place to just virtually connect with someone.
And there's an illusion almost of a community.
Illusion. Yes, of a community, of support from people, which can be true. We saw that a lot of groups are made online and they are very effective, such as breast cancer support groups or, sure, anything like that.
Or even online dating, you know, does end up with real significant potential
this
relationships.
This is very true. But to go back to your question about who's at risk of more excessive and pathological use, I would say the teenagers, because they're not really well developed yet to know where the limit is. And I would say more the people with psychopathologies at baseline, or the personalities that are more reclusive than others, people who are shy or avoidant, might go to social media more than others.
What type of pressure, Dr. Blatchford, do you think gets generated? Because that's something that's often referred to, or I think that's noted, that within the world of social media, there's a certain amount of a virtual kind of an illusory world, not really a real world,
yeah,
and there's a lot of peer pressure that gets generated from looking at people's pictures on Facebook, mm, and their lives. Everyone's putting forth this kind of illusion,
true,
as opposed to a real, authentic self. Mm. What do you find, or what do you think about that?
Well, I think something important about that, one of the key things about social media is that you are sharing personal information. And that can lead to, and when you're looking at other people's personal information, it can lead to jealousy, anger, people can judge you, you can become depressed, and that kind of leads also to the cyberbullying, people posting negative things on other people's walls, people seeing something that someone else has posted and saying something very negative about it. That can make, you know, make someone very...
And people can jump on that bandwagon en masse. I mean, there have been stories about that. And you know there's been stories about teens committing suicide,
yeah,
as a result,
yes,
of that. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with psychiatrist Teresa Blatchford and Mirabel Matar. We're talking about the effects of the use of social media on mental health. So you did recently, the two of you engaged in kind of an analysis or a study. Tell us about what you did and why. Why did you do it?
Well, it started with I was on call and there was a patient who came to the ER, to the emergency room, saying that she was suicidal after someone unfriended her on Facebook. And it was very surprising to me that this is the amplitude that someone can feel that distressed after a certain act on social media. And then I started looking up stuff with Teresa, and we did a meta-analysis or a literature review of many articles that talk about mental illness as with social media. The findings were very surprising at times.
So that's what you basically did. So in doing that, how long of a time frame did you look at? In other words, is it mostly recent things that have been written? How far back did your research go, Teresa? Do you remember?
I think it was in the last 4 or 5 years, and actually there was not a lot of research before that because social media has started mainly in 2000s and something. So I remember that we went far along, but there was not a lot of things before.
But so overall, what I mean, you know, it clearly you found certain, well, let's start with something that I guess is maybe uncharted. What were some of the positive things? Because obviously you didn't only find negative. What were some of the positive things you found? In terms of the use of social media or the internet with mental illness?
Some of the more positive things had to do with support. There was a study of women with breast cancer, and ones that posted on social media were found to feel that they had more support, were able to say encouraging things to other women, which made them feel good. Also with hemodialysis patients that were using the internet for research actually had more knowledge and were happier.
How about this idea of internet therapy? Because that's something that's been posited before as a potential help to people who are in physically are isolated locations and or maybe don't have the means to find, you know, some kind of mental health support.
Yes, they talked more about two things. One is telepsychiatry, which is a real psychiatrist or psychologist is sitting in their office and they're talking to someone in a rural area, which is what me and Teresa have done here at the VA. But the other part was were the applications that we can use online, either free or paid, where you can get therapy without really going anywhere. And without even seeing a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but by talking to the computer and putting in your symptoms and then getting back cognitive and behavior therapy, which is more like a teaching therapy that tells you, okay, so now you are anxious, do this, do that.
So very pragmatic, practical suggestions for people.
Yes.
Is there any research that supports the efficacy of that type of therapy?
Yes, it has shown that they are very successful, especially because it is a very pragmatic approach. There was a new application that is called Mood Gym, MOODGYM, where you put they have a lot of questions and then they put you in a certain category and then they ask you questions. So it has been shown to be very effective, yep.
So getting back to some of the negatives now, because those obviously are positives, and we all know that there are a lot of positives about staying in touch with your friends, your family, and all the good things that social media offer. But you did find some negative findings. Can you just give me a sense overall of what you found?
When I first got interested in this topic as well, it was from seeing patients in the ER, and what I've seen is people being very upset about being bullied in social media to the point where they're depressed and they're self-harming and wanting to even think about committing suicide. So cyberbullying was a big negative that is really very, very dangerous and scary that it's going on and it's having that effect. So some of the studies looked at kind of what some of the characteristics were of the people being bullied and the people that were doing the bullying, and actually found that they had a lot of similar characteristics, but the people doing the cyberbullying were actually different than the ones doing kind of in-person bullying in schools and things.
In what way?
The people that were doing the in-person bullying were not the same ones that were doing it in social media, although they had the same characteristics of kind of antisocial behavior, aggressiveness, that kind of thing. So I'm not sure why certain people
would gravitate
it's
to the cyber versus the real.
Right.
Well, it must be harder in some sense to face your
victim
yeah, as opposed to. There's an anonymity or potential of anonymity in the cyber world, and I think that's something that's been talked about a lot is people can, especially teens perhaps,
yeah.
It's too easy in a sense to engage in that kind of behavior.
This
is true. Yeah. So at this point, there was also some correlation, I guess, between this notion of spreading suicidal thoughts. And again, do you think that that has been a significant factor?
It has been significant, especially in the teenagers population, where it's like a copycat suicide. When they see that someone is posting, oh, I'm feeling so sad, I want to commit suicide, other people start thinking, oh, maybe I should do the same thing because I'm also feeling depressed. It's very tough to deal with.
So in the little bit of time we have left, because we're running out of time, what do you conclude? What is there more research that has to be done? What should we be doing?
Yeah, I think the overall message is social media is very powerful, and there are a lot of things it can be used for that are positive. There's a lot of information out there. It's a great way to get information out and to also monitor trends, do research, give information, and even for treatment. But just to be aware that there's possibility for addiction, bullying, depression, that all those can kind of come with it, especially with excessive use.
So use with care.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Thanks very much for coming in. My guests have been Dr. Teresa Blatchford. She's a fourth-year psychiatry resident at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Mirabel Matar, a child and adolescent psychiatry fellow also at Upstate Medical University. Next up, the power of bone marrow transplants. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. In 1956, the first successful human bone marrow transplant was performed, and it was found that infusion of marrow from an identical twin could result in complete remission of leukemia. Well, since then, there have been many breakthroughs in this technique, resulting in reducing the deaths from diseases like leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma, and more. Joining us with more on all of this is Charlene Hubble. She's the supervisor of the Stem Cell Processing Laboratory, and Sue Burns, oncology-certified registered nurse and bone marrow transplant coordinator at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with the basics. Sue, let me ask you to explain for our listeners, what exactly is a bone marrow transplant?
Bone marrow transplant, and now we call it stem cell transplant, are used interchangeably. Bone marrow actually takes the marrow from the patient's bone marrow. Stem cell, it's drawn peripherally. What it is just a process where someone with certain cancer diagnoses can receive very, very high-dose chemotherapy with a stem cell rescue, the rescue being what we do with their own stem cells or autologous, or could be an allogeneic transplant where it's someone else as a donor cell. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to receive the high-dose chemotherapy and recover it. The bone marrow would not recover from the doses of chemotherapy that we give. So by giving them an infusion of their own stem cells or donor stem cells, their bone marrow is able to replenish and they can recover from the transplant process.
So the bottom line is what this bone marrow transplant allows at this point is for the patient to get maximum therapy in the form of chemotherapy or radiation of something of that nature, and then still have a viable way of producing red blood cells. And actually, that's what I wanted to get to next. Charlene, tell me, what does it mean when you talk about bone marrow?
Right.
Explain what that is and what is its function in the body.
So in the marrow of your bones, particularly the lung bones of your leg and the bones in your chest, are the cells that help you to make red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. All of the cells you need to carry oxygen, to make your blood clot, to fight infection. And
it's necessary for life, basically.
It's necessary for life. And there are these magic little cells that we call hematopoietic stem cells in your marrow, and they replicate, and they can turn into red cells, they can turn into white cells, they can turn into platelets. And so they're the cells that when we give them to either the patient's own back or from a donor, the magic part is we just infuse them and they find their way to the marrow where they belong, and then they replicate and they grow and they restore the patient's whole ability to make red cells and white cells and platelets.
Wow. Well, tell me again then, Sue, when are these indicated? You've alluded to certain, we've talked about lymphoma potentially. So when is the bone marrow transplant mostly being used? What types of illnesses?
The illnesses that are treated with bone marrow stem cell transplant are leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma, and there's certain solid tumor cancers that are treated with it as well. like somebody, you know, diagnosed with, say, lymphoma, for instance, they would get their diagnosis, have all their testing done for the diagnosis. They would receive chemotherapy, possibly radiation therapy as well, to put them hopefully in a remission from the lymphoma diagnosis. Then either they would be observed for a while, and if the lymphoma relapsed, then they would go on for transplant. Or if it's highly resistant.
If it's a type of lymphoma that generally relapses, has a high rate of relapse, right, they may get a transplant up front.
But they always receive chemotherapy first to hopefully get them in remission. Some patients are not in total remission. They could be in a partial remission and still go on to bone marrow transplant.
You were starting to explain, Charlene, what someone was alluding to earlier, I think actually Sue, about the different types of transplants. So help us clarify that.
So for example, we have a lot of patients with multiple myeloma, and we can recover their stem cells, put them in the freezer and keep them, then give them their high-dose chemotherapy, give them back their own cells, and they'll recover because their marrow doesn't have myeloma cells in it. But a patient with acute leukemia, where the tumor is actually infecting their marrow, they need to get cells from another donor. So they get what we call allogeneic, where someone else donates.
And they try to match that in some way.
And sometimes that's somebody who's related to them, like a sibling, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's a person who's totally unrelated to them through a national marrow donor program that finds donors for people who don't have one. Yes, because they need to be perfectly matched. And so that's the whole purpose of the National Marrow Donor Program.
Similar to any kind of transplant,
correct,
you don't want to develop that host, you know, rejection,
right,
phenomenon. So you need to have a good match. And now there are national registries,
right,
to do
there are
that.
There are over 5 million people, mm-hmm, in the national registry who are people like you and I or the other family members or whatever who have said, I'll donate my cells to someone who needs them.
Wow. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm here with Charlene Hubbell and Susan Burns, and we're talking about bone marrow transplants and what they are and why we do them. So help us understand then what you were alluding to it, or actually outlining it somewhat, what takes place. So in certain circumstances, you have to have the treatment before you, but in those cases, why aren't the stem cells injured during that process? In other words, if the stem cells are harvested following treatment, how do you protect them?
The hope is that when you give the chemotherapy up front to put somebody in remission, the stem cells, the bone marrow will be healthy bone marrow. And then there's a point in time where then it's okay to collect the stem cells. They have recovered from the chemotherapy, and hopefully there aren't any cancer cells left in that bone marrow or stem cell. And then the patients always have to receive more chemotherapy to totally obliterate their bone marrow.
It's really a matter of the amount, the strength of the chemotherapy.
Right.
So if you have breast cancer, for example, you might get chemotherapy, and that's at a dose that your bone marrow can tolerate, your liver can tolerate, etc. But when you need a transplant, what we want to do is give you a greater dose of chemotherapy, because we think that if we can give you more drug, we actually have a chance to get rid of your tumor or your disease. But that amount of drug is enough that it will damage your marrow.
But why don't you take the stem cells in advance of the chemo?
We take the stem cells in advance of the high-dose chemotherapy.
I see.
Is what we call it.
That's clarifying
it. Then we store them. So sometimes patients have their cells stored for just about
years,
a month or two, and sometimes for years.
And they're frozen?
They're frozen in liquid nitrogen.
Wow.
And we can keep them for 20 years if we need to.
Very briefly, give me an overview of the process in terms of harvesting. In other words, mm-hmm, how is it harvested and then how is it put back? Either of you who'd like,
sure,
to start.
The traditional way was to recover bone marrow. And that requires you to aspirate it from the middle of people's bones. It's quite an arduous process for both the person doing it and for the patient.
I would imagine painful.
The patient had to have general anesthesia, etc. And in the last 30 years, we've discovered that some of these cells circulate through your bloodstream, and that we can give patients drugs, what we call mobilizing factors, that help, that increase the number of those cells that are circulating through their peripheral blood, and then we can collect those cells by a process called apheresis.
So you're basically harvesting them by drawing blood, right, and then screening, right, somehow filtering the blood, right, for these stem cells.
Exactly. And sometimes that process takes 3 or 4 days for a patient, for us to harvest enough stem cells that we know we'll have enough when we need to transplant them.
And then how are they put back, Sue?
They're put back, the patient is going to have a central venous catheter placed, PICC line. Something into a large vein. And they will get their chemotherapy, and then there's usually a day of rest, and then the day zero is their when they get their stem cell reinfusion. And they're thawed from being frozen. They're thawed in a warm saline bath. They're still a little bit on the cool side. And then the physician will draw them up from the stem cell bag in a syringe and then just push them in through the central catheter with the syringe.
And what the magic is, as you very aptly put it, Charlene, is that magically they find their way.
They know where to go. We call it homing.
Yes.
To the marrow where they belong, and then they engraft there.
So,
and the process generally takes between 8 to 14 days,
right,
before we can tell that their cells have engrafted and they start to make their own. And Sue can tell you about what it's like for the patient.
Yeah, what is it like for the patient, Sue?
So the high-dose chemotherapy not only obliterates the bone marrow, but it obliterates any rapidly growing cells like hair, the GI tract. So the patients, they lose their hair. They develop a lot of nausea, could be vomiting and diarrhea along with it. They also could develop skin rashes, and the skin can actually slough off. During that process, they're treated with, you know, pain medications, antibiotics, IV fluid, blood products. They get red blood cells and platelet transfusions. And then they also will get the growth factor Neupogen to help them recover their bone marrow.
Help the little cells grow.
Exactly. It still is about a 8 to 14 day process from the time they get their stem cells back until they can be discharged from the hospital, till we know that at least their bone marrow is in the growing phase and grafting phase, and they're safe enough to go home without developing major infections.
And then obviously they need to be followed.
And then
regularly.
They're monitored 2 to 3 times a week. They get their blood drawn, see the doctor to be sure that everything is still going in the right direction. Sometimes they need a little extra IV fluid. They need to keep very, very well hydrated, which is difficult to do when you're still having issues with nausea, because the nausea can continue for several weeks even after leaving the hospital. So we give them some extra IV fluid in the cancer center to help them along a little bit.
Overall, what have your experiences been? Have they been mostly positive and effective in terms of these bone marrow transplants?
These are diseases that are, we don't necessarily cure everyone, but we certainly extend their life. So an example of that is multiple myeloma, which is commonly now treated with stem cell transplant. And while it's not a curative procedure for myeloma, it extends their life. We've had patients who've lived as long as 10 years.
Wow.
And that is
well,
a lot
substantive
for people who have myeloma. And it allows people to reach landmarks in their life, see things they want to see, that otherwise they would miss out on.
But there are complications, as you've alluded to, that can really be quite serious.
There are. There can be serious complications. And when you get your own stem cells back, the complications aren't quite as severe as if you get a donor transplant, you know, someone else's cells. You're going to have some graft versus host disease, which can affect just about any organ in your body. You have to take anti-rejection medications. And that's a longer process to recover.
Right. Well, what is available in very little bit of time we have left? What are you offering right now in this
right
regard?
Now,
how many are you
right.
doing? And
right
how
now at University Hospital, we do autologous transplants, meaning we collect the patient's own cells. And the diseases we primarily treat are lymphoma, myeloma, and we also some acute leukemias. We do about 35 to 40 a year.
Wow.
And we have a specialized unit where the patients are cared for because they need to be in a specialized unit. with specialized nurses.
Well, it sounds like an amazing breakthrough and transformation in terms of care for all of these incredible, what were really devastating diseases.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Yes, my guests have been Charlene Hubbell, who is the supervisor for the stem cell lab processing laboratory at Upstate Medical University, and Susan Burns, oncology certified registered nurse and bone marrow transplant coordinator at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for sharing all this very interesting and helpful information.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Dr. Derek Cooney, an associate professor of emergency medicine, tells us all about bites and stings.
Most insect bites cause little more than mild pain, itch, and redness. This is the result of insects injecting small amounts of venom, blood thinners, and other substances into the skin. Some people may be more sensitive than others to these substances. Anaphylaxis is a severe life-threatening allergic reaction that can occur in individuals who are allergic to certain bites and stings. Common examples would be bee, wasp, hornet, and yellow jacket stings, and certain ant bites. Signs that someone could be having a life-threatening reaction include a fast heart rate, swelling at the site, hives, nausea, abdominal pain, difficulty breathing, chest tightness, facial or throat swelling, lightheadedness, or even passing out. In people without this sensitivity, or in the case of less serious bites by spiders, mosquitoes, flies, and other ants, there is usually a mild reaction that can typically be treated by moving to an area away from the insects, removing any stingers, washing with soap and water, and applying a cold pack. Taking ibuprofen and other over-the-counter pain relievers may also help. Antihistamines like Benadryl and topical creams like hydrocortisone may also keep the swelling down and help with the itch. For severe allergic reactions like anaphylaxis, however, 911 should be called, and that individual should receive immediate care from the EMS providers and emergency medicine doctors at the emergency department. If the patient is known to have a severe allergy to bites or stings, they may even carry an EpiPen or a Twinject. These are designed to give a pre-measured dose of a drug called epinephrine. These should be used as directed by the physician that wrote the prescription for the patient, but if they need help administering the EpiPen to themselves, it is important to remember that the open end must be aimed down against the thigh and the auto-injector held firmly in place for several seconds before removing the device and massaging the injection site for 10 seconds. If the person is nauseated or vomiting, be sure to lay them over on their side to prevent choking, and if they stop breathing or no longer have a pulse, it is important to start CPR. Even in cases of mild bite and sting, it is also possible to have complications, including skin infections, so you should watch out for spreading redness and streaking and pain. This requires evaluation by a doctor, and antibiotics may be needed. If the redness and streaking spread quickly, a trip to the emergency department is a good idea. Avoiding areas where stinging insects are seen flying or where hives are noticed, wearing insect repellent, avoiding anthills, and gardening with protected hands are some of the good ways to try to avoid bites and stings altogether.
Coming up next, optic neuritis and multiple sclerosis, a dangerous duo. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. 20 to 30% of patients with multiple sclerosis first show the disease with visual symptoms known as optic neuritis. And 60 to 70% of patients with MS have optic neuritis at some point in their disease. So what characterizes this relationship between the two? And what does it tell us about multiple sclerosis in general? Here with some answers is Dr. Luis Mexico, professor of ophthalmology and professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Mexico. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be back.
So let's begin with some basic definitions. Help us understand again, what basically is MS, multiple sclerosis?
So multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease. It's probably the most common autoimmune disease of the central nervous system. So
autoimmune.
So the immune system, which is the system that fights infection, bugs, and so on, turns against our own bodies. So examples of autoimmune disease in other parts of the body would be diabetes and rheumatoid arthritis and so on. In the case of the central nervous system, so we're talking about the brain and the spinal cord, multiple sclerosis is the most common disease. So the immune system is fighting our own body, in this case, the central nervous system.
And what happens? What does it do?
So it will attack primarily the sheath that covers neurons that is called myelin, and it will affect clinically with symptoms such as optic neuritis, that is today's topic, but sometimes without causing any symptom, just leaving a scar in the brain, for example.
And it's periodic?
It's periodic. It comes and goes. The most common form of multiple sclerosis is called relapsing remitting because it comes and goes. There's other forms of multiple sclerosis. By large, that is the most common.
And does it get progressively worse over time? Is that another characteristic?
Yes. So there is a phase where we have relapses and remissions, and then there's a secondary progressive phase where the disease gradually progresses. This is several years into the illness if left untreated.
And some people really have a more severe form, and others have a milder form or a less progressive form in terms of their lifelong experience with the disease?
Absolutely. Just like anything else, just like a simple pneumonia can be something very mild, or it can be extremely severe and life-threatening, similar with multiple sclerosis. But the good news is that for the most part, it tends to be a moderate disease that is certainly amenable to treatment.
So let's get back to optic neuritis. So what is that, and what is its relationship to MS? You alluded to it a minute ago.
Yeah, so optic neuritis is a general term that means inflammation of the optic nerve. However, the majority of people with optic neuritis is the form that it may be related to multiple sclerosis later on or as part of the disease, like you mentioned in the introduction. The optic nerve, you can view it as a cable that connects the eyeball with the brain, bringing vision primarily. But if one looks a little more carefully, it actually has the same microanatomy as the brain. So we have neurons that are in the retina, the inner layer of the eye, and just about 1 million nerve fibers in each eye will form what we call the optic nerve. So they merge in the retina to a meeting point, if you will, and from there on they travel into the brain in what is called the optic nerve. And at that point is that the sheath of myelin, this cover, almost like an electric cable that has a cover, develops. And that's the focus of the inflammation that we call optic neuritis.
So in fact, in a sense, the neuritis or the optic neuritis, is it a harbinger or is it it's an early warning, perhaps, of a later development of something like MS?
Many times it is. About 20 to 30% of patients, like you mentioned, with multiple sclerosis debut with optic neuritis. And the majority of people with multiple sclerosis will have optic neuritis at one point or another. So it's very important when a person has optic neuritis to undergo a full evaluation because it may mean that they either already have multiple sclerosis or they're at high risk for multiple sclerosis.
So who's most likely to get the optic neuritis, though? Is one population, is it gender-specific, that kind of thing?
So anybody can develop optic neuritis, but the classical presentation is in a young woman, usually around 20 to 30 years old, and has a very specific presentation. The vast majority of people will have visual loss. The visual loss is central. More than 90% of patients will have pain when they're experiencing optic neuritis, and the pain is behind the eye, around the eye, and is triggered by eye movements. The majority of people with optic neuritis will have decreased perception of color, primarily red, And
so they won't be able to see the color red? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's sort of washed out, more maroon or orangey is the way people describe it. Vision worsens in the first 2 weeks of the presentation gradually, usually, and then sort of stabilizes for another week or two. And then for more than 90% of people, they start to improve. And vision returns to normal or near normal in more than 90% of patients. That is without any treatment.
So it does basically resolve on its own. But what's most significant about it is the fact, well, first of all, in some patients, is there a continued loss of vision?
Yes, unfortunately, there is a small percentage, about 8 to 10% of people that don't recover well. But even people that recover well will notice that, or may notice rather, that their vision is not perfect. And we rely so much on vision that even having a slight diminishment of vision will be
unsettling.
Exciting.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with neuro-ophthalmologist Dr. Luis Mexico, and we're talking about optic neuritis and its relationship to multiple sclerosis. So for many people, this diagnosis of optic neuritis is almost equivalent to having a high risk for MS. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, so a lot of what we know about optic neuritis comes from a pivotal study that was supported by the National Institute of Health that's called the Optic Neuritis Treatment Trial, ONTT for short. And this was a study that was done in the late 80s, early 90s, and we learned so much from that study that we're still quoting it 25 years later. So we learned from that study that there are some factors that increase the risk of developing multiple sclerosis. Having a family history of multiple sclerosis, having had symptoms prior to the optic neuritis that could suggest multiple sclerosis, of course, put you at a higher risk. But primarily was the appearance of the MRI. The MRI of the brain that is done at the time of the optic neuritis was a big predictor of the risk of developing multiple sclerosis.
Does everyone who develops optic neuritis definitely then go on to have MS?
No, fortunately not. So if the initial MRI was normal, completely normal, doesn't show any scar in the brain, the risk of developing multiple sclerosis is about 20 to 25%. So one out of four people, or one out of five even, will develop multiple sclerosis later on. However, if that initial MRI showed spots in the brain that were more characteristic of multiple sclerosis, even one spot, that increased the risk to 75%. So three out of four people will develop multiple sclerosis later on.
So what is the incidence of optic neuritis currently in the United States? I mean, how frequently does it occur?
Yeah, so overall it's about 1 to 5 cases per 100,000 population every year. Here in upstate New York, central New York, we're a little higher risk due to a latitude effect. So
what is that?
The farther we live from the equator, the more likely to develop optic neuritis or multiple sclerosis.
Do they understand the relationship there?
We don't quite understand it very well. There seems to be a link with vitamin D, maybe, and exposure to sunlight. And this is true in the northern hemisphere as well as in the southern hemisphere.
That's very interesting and probably worthy of continued study.
Yes.
And puzzling, as you said. So going back to this notion of the relationship between the two, why is it so important, you know, the fact that if you have optic neuritis and you could potentially be at risk for MS, what does it, you know, what is the significance of that in terms of treatment?
Probably the greatest significance is that since the early to mid-90s, medications were developed for multiple sclerosis, and we have treatment now, and we haven't found a cure, so to speak, but the treatments have become more and more effective and better tolerated over the years. When these medications came out in the early 90s and mid-90s, and even more recently, we also looked at this population that was at high risk for developing multiple sclerosis, primarily after developing optic neuritis, but also other presentations. So when they have an abnormal MRI, when these people have an abnormal MRI at the clinical presentation, they may or may not meet criteria for multiple sclerosis, but they are at high risk. So these medications several of them have been tested in this group at risk and proven that the risk of developing multiple sclerosis is significantly diminished when people go on treatment early
on. Wow. So that's very significant.
That's right. That's one of the things that changed how we treat optic neuritis in a dramatic way.
So basically looking at it as a harbinger, a potential harbinger of the MS developing later on, you start to treat early for the MS.
Yes, yes.
And that early treatment can literally diminish the possibility of getting it?
Exactly. And also improve the quality of life and postpone that evolution that we had spoken about into a secondary progressive phase from the relapsing remitting form of the disease.
Tell us a little bit more about what's going on in the world of MS today in terms of treatment, though. You were alluding to certain kinds of treatments. Tell us about the whole treatment protocol these days and the effectiveness.
Yeah, so multiple sclerosis medications can be divided into different generations. So the first generation of medications were medications where the efficacy was about a third. So they slowed down the disease by about a third, which
and
is quite an accomplishment.
Yes, those began in the 90s, you said.
Those began in the early to mid-90s, and they were developed even into the early 2000s. And these were four medications that were available in the United States. The four medications were injectable by self-injection, and some were subcutaneous. One was intramuscular. Then, as we move into the 2000s, other medication strategies have come out. So the first one to come out was a medication that is given intravenously once a month, highly effective, but with some risks attached. And as of more recent, we have another wave of medication that are actually oral. These are pill forms. And two of the three have more efficacy, in broad terms, reducing the disease progression by about two-thirds.
Wow.
So now we're talking about significant slowing down of the disease.
So there is no cure, but at this point you can manage the disease, slow down its progression, and perhaps diminish the symptoms?
Absolutely. For most people with multiple sclerosis, the management can be quite successful. And there is a lot of research in multiple sclerosis. The pipeline, as we say, is full with promise and new medications coming down the road. So there's certainly a lot of hope for multiple sclerosis and probably finding that holy grail, that cure that we're all waiting for.
You think it's possible?
Oh, we all think it's possible. Absolutely.
Interesting, though, to me, I'm just coming back to that relationship that you alluded to earlier about the change in latitude, the latitude effect. It sounds to me like could be something that could unlock some key to this whole story.
Yeah, so some people have pursued this farther and farther. And in recent years, vitamin D has become a main player. And we don't have a definitive answer yet, but the recommendation is that patients with multiple sclerosis take vitamin D supplement, have their vitamin D levels checked, and race if needed.
Terrific information. Thanks so much. And vitamin D is probably good for all of us for lots of reasons. My guest has been Dr. Luis Mexico, professor of ophthalmology and professor and chair of neurology at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Medical student Brielle Stanton enjoys writing poetry. She creates a haunting portrait of a smoker's addiction in her poem, The Cough. Now that we have banished smoking from public places, we have also banished those who smoke from being with us. Her poem suggests we have encouraged them to lie and hide from the truth. Here is The Cough. Sitting across the table, I'm a world apart. Coffee-stained teeth bite my tattered lower lip. I'm starving. So which one of my lies will I spit? The clinking of forks grows unbearable. Cafe chatter screeches, hammering spikes into my skull. My worn watch ticks 20 past my nicotine fix. My feet tap dangerously, shamelessly, stomping imaginary bugs on the floor. Excusing myself, I slip away to the back. Locked in a stall of solace and etched names carved and chipped, I know dinner is mine. scrambling through my satchel for a single light. My hand falls in place around the dirty paintbrush, dipped in black to smother my lungs, to coat my insides with steady strokes. I find the warm embrace, a craving's ease. Worries subside, charred and blistered. Nothing acknowledges their presence but a puff and aftertaste. An easy breath for a few cold nights, marked by a smoky reticence. Taste buds relaxed with the massage of menthol. Chemicals rise on a hot air balloon tour through the compact gray folds of my brain, then plummet, anchor in hand, to tickle my stomach, tingle my fingers, and calm my restless toes. I return to the table, pushing back the menu, smiling tightly, shoving the cough back down into the caverns of my chest.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we explore a new, minimally invasive technique for surgery of the salivary glands. And in light of all the mass shootings nationally, how local law enforcement is preparing. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.